Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I am Ann Clark, a member of the club and the Business and Leadership Forum. I will be your chair for this evening's program, A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Business of Film and Television Writing, with Richard Walter from UCLA's renowned film school. A Hitchhiker's Guide is one of those programs that we have had a lot of interest in because many people know about Richard and know about his writings and know about his book, which will be available tonight, Essentials of Screenwriting. And when we are finished with our program here, what we will do is have Richard sign copies of his program in the library where you can buy his book. So you're going to be looking for this book. And we welcome your comments about this book and any information that you want to provide, Richard. We'll also be passing around an email sign-up for those who want to sign up to get on Richard's email list. So remember, before we leave tonight, if you wish to do that, be sure and do it, and we'll also pass it around as we go ahead with our program. For those of you who are meeting Richard for the first time tonight, he is internationally known as a master teacher, a pop culture critic, and a media pundit. Students in the programs he supervises has been amazingly successful. What I know personally about Richard is that he is an absolutely wonderful and gifted teacher, and that he always shares his information and his experiences with his students and with the people that he knows in one of the most generous ways that I know of anyone. So I'm delighted to welcome Richard Walter tonight to our Commonwealth Club and his presentation.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you, Ann Clark, and thank you all for coming, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club. She wields a mean gavel, huh? I got to get me one of them gavels. Maybe my wife will listen to me if I'm banging on the table. I'm going to just send around the sheet. I promise I will not. I know you're thinking, the one thing I need in my life is more spam. If you sign up, you'll get the free email newsletter that I put out every month and occasional tips and thoughts and stuff like that. What I promise I won't do is give away or sell the addresses. So is there anybody anywhere who's not writing a screenplay? I'm shamelessly wallowing in self-promotion over this book. The real work begins when you write a book after the book is written. And I've been traveling around the country, and I was in New York. But never mind New York and L.A. I was actually in Minneapolis. Partly to promote the book and partly to address a trade group, an industrial group. And when I got into the limousine that they had sent for me that met me at the airport, I said to the driver, just for a gag, just as a little giggle, I said, so how's the script coming along? And he turns, he's at the wheel. I thought he's going to run off the freeway there. He says, and his eyes as big as basketballs, he says, how did you know? If you're not writing a screenplay, the only possible excuse for not writing a screenplay, the only possible explanation is that you're writing a book about how to write screenplays. There are sure a lot of them. Or you're conducting seminars on how to write screenplays. I have a friend, Vicky King, who wrote a book called How to Write a Screenplay in 21 Days. I'm always saying to her, why should it take so long? And she said, we don't compete with each other in our books and our screenplays, our seminars, our screenwriting seminars. We're really... they're like cookbooks. People buy bunches of them, and they go to bunches of these seminars, and what we're really doing is contributing to writer's block. People go to these events, read these books instead of working on their scripts. All of the various pundits generally agree with Aristotle, who wrote this little ragged pamphlet called The Poetics about 2,500 years ago, and that really is the user's guide for dramatic narratives. And essentially what it says is story is everything. It's all about story. You already knew that. It's not about texture. It's not about tone. It's not about theme. It's first, all of those things are important, but And character and dialogue, of course, but all of those are functions of story, what happens in the darn narrative, and that's what a narrative is, it's a story. I had quite an experience about, 5 weeks ago, for the first time. I've spoken to gazillions of groups, but in Chicago, late September, I addressed an evangelical Christian conference. It was I was in a megachurch with 500 pastors. The first thing I told them was, I'm not an evangelical Christian, not a Christian at all. I don't belong to any organized religion. I'm a Jew. And if you think that the Bible is the Word of God, then what does that tell you about God? It tells you that among all the other things he is, he's also a powerful storyteller. I mean, Scripture is mainly stories, isn't it? There are observations and commentaries and stuff like that, but mainly it's stories. And those stories are here and there, comforting stories and uplifting stories, but for the most part, they're the opposite of that. They're really bloodthirsty, perverse, horribly violent stories. And if you are writing such screenplays, you're godly. You're doing what God does. I was traveling to one of these seminars that I give that Vicky had been talking about just a moment earlier that I referred to, where I was going to Nevada, actually, to talk at the University of Nevada Las Vegas campus. And just before I left, the phone rang, and it was an administrator from the university, and she said, we're so excited to contemplate your visit here, Professor Walter. And I still look over my shoulder when they call me that. We're on the quarter system, unlike Cal. I understand there is a campus of the University of California right here in the Bay Area. Not just in Los Angeles, there's one actually here. And they're on the semester system, but most of the University of California is on the quarter system. This is my 100th quarter. I fell into it at a party in Malibu, and what a lucky circumstance it is. I recently told the chancellor, 100 more quarters, and if it still hasn't worked out for me, then that's it, I'm out of here. The fact is that the phone rings, and it's this administrator from Nevada, and she says, we're looking forward to your appearance here. I'm just calling to remind you to be certain to bring your passport. I said, I don't need a passport to go to Nevada. This isn't Arizona. This is Nevada. Actually, this is well before the Arizona legislation. It was actually after the Simpson-Mazzoli legislation. Anybody remember that? Remember Kimbo Wood and Nannygate and all of that? She had hired an undocumented caretaker for her children. And they had passed the Simpson-Mazzoli immigration legislation. Let's call it what it is, anti-immigration legislation that was requiring employers to verify that the people who work for them actually are documented and so on. And we're not going to get into politics tonight. That's not what this is about. But I will volunteer that I don't like being turned into a policeman in my own home. It even says in the legislation that you must ask for the papers in a German accent. It says that in the, may I have your papers, please? In any event, I said, I don't need a passport to go to Nevada. And she said, that's true, but to teach at the University of Nevada, you do. We because of Simpson-Mazzoli, we have to verify everybody's employment. Now, somebody like me, who's coming there as a professor at another university and likely is already documented. It's going to be more of an issue for people who are, typical of immigrants, less educated, more economically oppressed and downscale, likely to be working on the ground staff, on maintenance and facilities and stuff like that. But there's a rule at universities. We don't discriminate here. We treat everybody badly. So they have to ask everybody for their documentation. And I said, I lose things easily, important documents like passports, my keys, my train of thought, and what I'll do is I'll bring an expired passport. You can't, I never throw away my passports. That wife I mentioned before about the gavel, this is one battle we have in our lives. I'm a pack rat, and I never throw away stuff, including passports. We decided we're going to give the marriage another 43 years, and if it still hasn't worked out, that's it. I'm out of here. In any event, I have all of my passports from my very first passport, and I can actually pile them up together and make a little pocket movie out of them. You know, and you can watch me grow old. In fact, if you're as old as I am, it's kind of like watching a Wizard of Oz, because it starts in black and white and goes to color. You know, the first few portraits were still being done in black and white. So she said, "Well, that won't do. An expired passport won't do." I said, "Well, why not? I couldn't have gotten even merely an expired passport if I hadn't been a citizen in the first place." And she said, "Yes, but," and I could hear her hesitating. I could hear the pain as she was asking me and advising me what she's required to advise me. She said, "But how does the University of Nevada know that since the expiration of that passport, you haven't renounced your citizenship?" And there's a question. I guess that's a question you could ask. And she went on to say, "Look, if you think that's ridiculous, I agree with you, Professor, but I didn't make this rule. I can't change it. And I'm telling you, if you don't bring the passport, you can't teach your event here." So I brought the passport. But you could get an impression that there's a real problem in this country, which is hordes of teeming, huddled masses trying at the borders, really the southern border. I don't think they're too worried about B.C. up there. Trying to get across into this country with what can only be the clear intention of teaching screenwriting seminars. I mean, there are a lot of these seminars. What the various pundits all agree about, as I've already told you, it's all about story. It's all about story. You have to write a good story. Write a great story, and don't photograph it that well. Don't have such a great musical score. Don't edit it that well, and it'll play. Imagine the converse of that, though, a really beautifully photographed wonderfully acted, bad script. How useful could that be? So it really is all about the writing. It is all about creating a great story. There's one disagreement that I have with one particular pundit. Doesn't matter who it is. His initials are Robert McKee. Anybody ever seen McKee? Bob says that whatever you do, what you must not do is write your own personal little story. This is what amateurs do. There are writers who tend to write their own little personal story, and you should avoid that. If you want to be treated as a professional, you have to treat yourself as a professional. And what a professional does is keep aware of the grosses, what was selling, what movie sold tickets last weekend, and plot the trends and calculate what's appealing now to the movie industry, and so on. And the last thing anybody cares about is your rinky-dinky little old personal story. Don't do that. If you have to do that and get it out of the way, put it in a drawer and leave it alone and move on to treating yourself seriously. He goes on to say that this is a mistake, writing the personal story, the personal screenplay, that is made mainly by women writers, he says. Now, if there's a mistake, let's call the mistake X, and if there's a class of writers, in this instance, women writers, according to Bob, who make that mistake, you could conclude logically that he believes women writers are inferior to men writers, and that's kind of a sexist view. Now, I'm not here to criticize him because I have a sexist view too, but it's the opposite of that. I think women writers are better than men. I think just generally women are better people than men. And it has to do with the ability of women in this culture, and not only this culture, to share much more intimately with each other information about each other. My wife and her women friends, I think, know much more about their personal lives and the painful and difficult issues that everybody experiences in life compared to myself and my male buddies. Men talk about safe stuff, sports. I hate sports. I understand, you know, I've never been... Got to start the whole thing over now. Thank you, Ann Clark. Thank you, Commonwealth Club. Just teasing.
I can gavel again.
So, yeah, that I want to see. That kind of makes me, I got to tell you, gets me excited. I don't know what that's all about, but who knows? Maybe we'll discover that this is San Francisco after all. In any event, the fact of the matter is that I have a pal I went to school with. I knew her when she was Debbie, but now she's Deborah Tannen. Do you know that name? She's a Georgetown university professor of linguistics, and she specializes in gender differences relative to language. And she had her first, I mean, she's had a huge number of best-selling books. Her first, I think, was called something like You Just Don't Understand, something like that. And it was on the New York Times list for 2 years, 8 months at number one. And essentially, Deborah believes that women engage in what she calls rapport talk, and men engage in report talk. And really, again, I was mentioning sports. What else do we talk about? I was saying that I don't really care about sports. I haven't been, you know, the University of California in Los Angeles, where I have been teaching now for over 30 years, has teams, I understand, that compete with teams from other institutions. It's incredible. I've never been to any of those. It just is so boring. I just get bored with it. I'm sorry. And that's what men talk about. What else do men talk about? They talk about stereo equipment and cameras and cars and things like that. Have you seen the specs for the new Sennheiser 460A noise-canceling headphones? They have a plus or minus decibel interference ratio. This is what passes for interaction among men, and it's not terribly interesting. And it doesn't really serve a creative expression, stories that are supposed to be probing and that are supposed to explore the difficult and the painful aspects of the human condition. Now, not knowing sports, you could think would be a handicap for a man, because a lot of the meetings where there are men involved involve sports talk. They start with sports talk. And I've discovered you don't need to know a thing about it if you just make the right noises, if you have the right rising and falling inflection and intonation, you can get away with anything. I'll actually walk into a meeting. I've actually done this. Walk into a meeting. There's a bunch of men, strangers. I've never met them before. I'm going to pitch a story at a studio or something. And I'll say, my first words out of my mouth, I'll say, how about that game? How about that game? And nobody will say, nobody dare say, what game? You know, it's because they should know. They ought to know. They'll reveal themselves being a wuss or something if they don't know which game. So they'll say, yeah. They'll give you a generic response like, whoa, that was something. And I'll say, you believe that guy? Do you believe that guy? And they'll say, how does he get away with it? And nobody knows what they're talking about. And again, we can chuckle about it here, and it's good fun, and I love a yuck. But it makes for really rotten screenplays. I'm here to tell you that the personal screenplay is the only screenplay that you can write, the only screenplay that you'll ever be able to write, that you should write. And you're going to write that script over and over and over again. Every work of art is a portrait of the artist who created it. We don't have time, unfortunately, today to go into the real details of it. But when people talk about story structure, nobody's really improved on the Aristotle. He says there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's funny, I was telling the Christians back in Chicago that Jesus Christ and Aristotle share one unfortunate aspect, which is they both have their names invoked on behalf of principles and causes that neither of them would ever support. I mean, can you imagine Jesus supporting the burning of the Quran in Florida, that guy Terry Jones, or showing up at the funerals of servicemen and women who died defending the country, screaming about their homophobic cheering on the deaths and so on. You know what I'm talking about, that the Westboro Baptist Church, I think they are. Christians tell me that they think they're treated unfairly in the media, and I agree with them. There's just too much attention paid to that stuff. Well, don't you think? In any event, the fact is Aristotle is often accused of having invented the three-act structure, and that's very much under attack now. And he never talked about acts. He just talked about beginnings and middles and ends. We don't have time for a sophisticated analysis of it, but the beginning is kind of short. The middle is big. The end is the shortest part of all. What can you think of that looks like that in this world? A human life, a narrative, a well-shaped narrative is kind of a model of a human life with childhood, kind of short, relatively short, big, fat middle, we hope, and then ideally a quick ending. Raise your hand high if you're looking forward to spending 3, 4, or 5 years on resuscitators and IVs and stuff like that. In a nursing home, I don't think so. So every work of art is a model of a human life. Whose life? The life of the writer that's creating that. So you can only write your own personal story. Anne talked earlier about an event that's coming up later here that had to do with alternative health care. And it's so funny that you said that, because a friend of mine, a professor at UCLA, a professor of public health, a longtime buddy of mine, I know him from way before UCLA, we just happened to end up there together. We grew up in Queens together, over 10 years ago now. He was writing a book on alternative health care. And he gave it to me. He said, "Hey, Richie, you're a writer. Take a look at this before I send it into the editor." And it opened with something like, "There has arisen in the last half century in the United States and around the world a broad array of new modalities in healthcare, alternative methods of delivering healing. And in this book, we will survey them, starting with blah, blah, and going on to da-da-da." I don't know. It struck me as really dull. And here's, after I spoke to him and gave him my advice, here's how the book opens. "In 1984, my infant son was badly burned in a household accident." That's the opening sentence of the book. Wouldn't you read on if you read that? Of course you would. Of course you would. "The doctors told my wife and me, not my wife and I, this is one of my pet peeves, told my wife and me, when it gets spoken wrongly a sufficient amount of times, they call it right, then it becomes right. "The doctors told my wife and me that he would require a skin graft, and this meant that he would have to be tied down in restraints on the hospital bed for 2 weeks, because otherwise he would scratch at the graft. And this would prove so upsetting for the parents that we would not be allowed even to see the child for 2 weeks." An infant, a three-month-old, a four-month-old for 2 weeks, that's like if I tell my friend Tom here, "Tom, hang on a second, just wait, I want to talk to you. Can you hang on until April, it's a long time, and that was just not acceptable to us. And so we were motivated to look for alternative modalities, and we found aloe vera. And it goes on to explain how they were able to heal the kid without any hospitalization, without any skin graft, and so on. Again, this is not about alternative health care. It's about the personal screenplay. And you can see how no matter what it is that you're writing about, if it's a personal story, people will get interested. And I went to school, film school myself. I'm many years at UCLA, but I was a student at another film school at USC. I just cannot for the moment remember the name of it. And our class was really the first to go on to own Hollywood. There was no tradition of moving to the professional community from the film school community until around the mid-late 60s. And my classmates really went on to own Hollywood, except for one who owns Marin County just across the bridge here. And you may not think that Star Wars is a terribly personal picture, but it is. George had a terrible, terrible relationship with his father. I remember Francis Ford Coppola telling me that when they formed Zoetrope, his company, George is a little younger than Francis, and George was kind of taken under Francis's wing as a kind of a protege mentor relationship. And Francis included him in Zoetrope, which is still located right here in San Francisco, as I'm sure you know. And he asked George. George's father is a Xerox executive, and he said, "Hey, Francis is not above looking for a bargain." And he said, "Can you ask your dad to get us maybe a discount on photocopy services?" And George said, "Don't ask me to ask my father for anything. I don't get along with my dad. We're kind of estranged. It's very awkward, and we don't have much to do with each other, and I'll never ask him for anything, so I can't help you with that. I'm sorry, no." Well, look at Star Wars. First of all, the protagonist is a character named Luke. Do you think that's an accident that a guy named Lucas calls his protagonist Luke? I don't know, let's call him Luke, It just kind of came to him out of nowhere. Who does that represent? And who's the villain in the piece? It's a guy named Darth Vader, V-A-D-E-R, V-A-T-E-R, German, Vater, means father, doesn't it? Darth Vader, dark father. "Hi, Luke, I am your father." It's a really personal story. It really, truly is. And all of the great work is personal. So my first lesson to you, my first appeal to you, is write your own personal story. As far as the trends are concerned, they are a hoax. There aren't any trends in Hollywood. Someone will say, well, vampires is big now, because there were like maybe 4 or 5 or 6 vampire movies. Well, there are hundreds and hundreds of movies coming out of mainstream Hollywood. And then, of course, when you're dealing with cable TV and independently produced, independently released pictures and so on, you're talking about thousands of movies worldwide, and a half a dozen of them hardly establishes a trend. But even if it was the trend, even if there were a trend, like it's algebra, you say, let X equal the trend, we'll call the trend X. It's too late to get in on that trend because it's the trend. That had to have been in the works years earlier, don't you think? At least 2 years earlier. So you just defeat yourself immediately when you start to plot and calculate what's selling now. You're working in your head, and we need our heads, but art ain't about the head. It's about the heart. It's about the belly. It's about the groin. It's not about thinking. It's not about understanding. It's about feeling. And I was telling the pastors, you want people to stay in that church even after they leave the church. And the way you do that is by exciting them, upsetting them, disturbing them, provoking them. I remember I'm a big Sopranos fan. We got any Sopranos fans here? I still am in mourning for the show. And they were doing a spoof in the third season, I think, of sort of the way, you know, everybody at a barbecue has a comment on how to do the meat. And Tony at one point is saying, you know, the meat still cooks after you take it off the grill. And you want the meat to still be cooking after you take it off the grill. That is to say, you want the people to stay in the church even after they leave the church, in their heads thinking about that. And you want them to stay in the theater even after they leave the theater, in their heads. And again, not so much their heads as their hearts and their bellies. I'm notorious for hating all movies. I don't hate all movies. I just hate most movies. But most art is pretty bad. We think in museums we see nothing but beautiful paintings, and we figure all paintings are beautiful, and we don't understand that for every one of those paintings there are thousands and thousands of paintings that are stupid and useless and worthless and have no business being there and aren't there. But film is contemporary to television even more so. In our faces, we don't have the time to do the culling and the selecting, so we get the impression that there sure is a lot of bad stuff out there. People don't understand that there's always a lot of bad stuff. It just drops away. The bad stuff drops away. When you look back, you know, people say constantly to me, oh, why don't they make movies like they did in the 30s and the 40s? You know, well, in the 30s and the 40s, they made a lot of good movies, but they also made a lot of turkeys. We've just forgotten about those. In any event, there are a lot of good movies, and one that I thought was really, really good, maybe not everyone will agree with me, but I bet most of you do, and that is Social Network. I thought that's a good movie. And again, when I left that movie, I was still in the theater with it, and the next day even more so. And even now I wonder about the nature of the value of an idea versus working out that idea, marking that idea. How much is writing the code worth? How much is just thinking up the notion of a Facebook and so on? There aren't any answers. It's not about answers. It's really about questions, isn't it? Really good questions just lead to finer answers. So the first thing is, again, personal. Be personal. Don't defeat yourself before you even get started by trying to figure out the trends. The other thing is, again, we have so little time, I can't even say hello, how are you in an hour. And we do want to leave some time for some questions. And then later on, I'll be signing books if people want to. There'll be an opportunity there to ask me questions. We can have an exchange. You can complain and kvetch and do anything that you want to do. Or share any thoughts that you have to share. You know, here in California, nobody tells anything to anybody or remarks about anything. We just share everything, don't we? We can share outside. I wanted to make sure that in this little bit of time that we have together, I tell you all that you have to know to succeed and become a trillionaire screenwriter. And it sounds crazy, but being a writer means placing yourself in the minds and the bodies of other people and trying to think like the characters in your movie, but also the characters in your life, and think the way they think. And I'm placing myself in your minds and your bodies. You got me thinking, well, how can that possibly be? But when I'm done with this, you'll understand and you'll agree that it really
people understand also why people don't succeed, it's really very easy to understand. And we are working our way to getting there. I wanted to come up with a second principle, though, that is so important. It's the one that we embraced at UCLA. Well, it's the two, the personal screenplay and the second principle, which I'm going to describe to you. And I believe these two principles explain the great success of our students. And when I say success, I'm talking about their transition from the academic film community into the professional community. We've been bragging in all the literature you can see. It's funny, sometimes people say, can you really teach this? Is something that can't be taught at all, you know? Well, can't we agree that we haven't hurt these writers? 10 projects with Spielberg, three Oscar nominations for best screenplay in the last 3 years, two Oscars, Milk and Sideways, and the guy that did win the Oscar, the one that did win the Oscar, which is Benjamin Button, that would have been Eric's second Oscar, or his third nomination. So can't we agree that we haven't at least hurt these writers? How are we doing that? Over the mic, I'm so sorry. I play with the thing.
He's going to be in a lot of trouble.
You hand a man an object like this, he's going to play with it. In fact, not just men, come to think of it, might play with this. San Francisco, right? The fact is that the second principle that is so important, every bit as important as the first one, is I call simply integration. At UCLA, there's this itinerant army. I mentioned this itinerant army of self-appointed educators that traipse around the country and the world giving seminars on screenwriting. They have a vested interest, somebody suggested, in mystifying the process. We're trying to demystify the process, and that's what I want to do here when I talk about integration. I want to tell you exactly what I mean when I say integration. I'm not talking about black and white together, we shall not be moved. The old civil rights days, I was a part of all of that. I'm proud to have been in Washington on August 28th, 1963. I have a dream today and all of that. Very exciting. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about another kind of integration, and here it is. The first thing is you have to recognize when you write a screenplay that a screenplay is nothing other than an elaborate list of only two kinds of information, just two kinds of information. What kinds? Sight, sound. Simple as that. This happens, that happens, and somebody says something. Sound. Now, there's a lot of sound in a movie. There is music. There are sound effects. There's even something called room tone. The sound of this room in absolute quiet is different from the sound in another room. If you listen to it carefully, they'll actually record that. If we were shooting a scene here on location in this room, they say, okay, shut up, everybody. For 20 seconds, we're going to just record room tone. Now, obviously, we're not writing about room tone as writers when we write about the sound. What are we writing? We're writing the dialogue. That's the main part of the equation as far as sound is concerned. I'd say 99.999% of the sound in a screenplay is the dialogue. So you got dialogue and you got action. You got the stuff that you see. You got the stuff that you hear. Here's what integration is. Integration, that, by the way, that's why I never want to see in a script a word like realize, remember, feel. I don't know what that looks like. You can only reveal that by focusing on what is seen and what is heard. You can say, you can cheat a little bit and say Marilyn's eyes widen in what can only be the realization that Harry took the gun from the whatever it is. But again, it's a visual. We've got to talk about what is seen and what is heard, not about mental processes that go on inside somebody's head. That's why novels are easier to write than screenplays. Now, sometimes people say, yeah, but a novel is longer than a screenplay. I've had modest success as a novelist. My last novel it was a relatively short novel. It was about 275 pages in print, and that's more than twice as long as a too long screenplay. So isn't that harder? And the answer is no, it's easier to write more than write less. There's a famous letter from Hemingway to Maxwell Perkins, his editor, in which he goes on and on and on for about 9 pages, and at the end He says, well, that's about it for now, Max. Please forgive me for writing such a long letter. I didn't have the time to write a short one. Takes more time to do the kind of work that artists have to do to cull and select and throw away. A lot of romance is very unromantic. It's throwing away. You do a lot of throwing away as an artist. The trick in maturing as an artist, as a writer in particular, is learning not just that you have to throw a lot of stuff away, but learning to love to throw stuff away. And that takes some doing. In any event, again, it's all about sight and sound. And here's what the sight and sound has to achieve. It has to move the story forward. That's all. Your script is integrated if every sight and every sound palpably, identifiably, measurably moves the story forward. And that's all there is to it. If you'll do that, it doesn't matter what you write, doesn't matter what the so-called genre is. I preach at UCLA and all around the world that there are really only two genres, good movies and bad movies. And a good movie is an engaging movie. Bad movie is boring. We only have one rule at UCLA. Don't be boring. That's all we ask of. And that's not an easy ideal, not an easy principle to live up to if you have to occupy 100 minutes or a couple of hours. Movies are so long these days. They go on and on and on, don't they? Generally too long. I think they should run about an hour 40 would be about right, 100 minutes. And boy, just to keep people engaged for 100 minutes, not an easy thing to do. A tall order. But that's all you have to do. It's hard enough to do it, but it is all that you have to do. You got to, again, remember that when you show every sound, it's got to move that story forward. If you do that, doesn't matter what the subject is, doesn't matter what happens in the movie, doesn't matter what happens in the scene. You can even have nothing happen in a scene, absolutely nothing happen in a scene. And if somehow that moves the story forward, audiences will be engaged by that. They will pay attention to that. Now, how can you have nothing happen in a scene and people get engaged by that? I'll give you an example written by a UCLA student, one of the Oscar winners. He won the Oscar for Sideways, Alexander Payne. Can we keep this in the room here? He's so good to me, and he gave me a beautiful blurb for my book. What did those two fine women see in those doofuses? I don't get it. Those men were so uninteresting in the movie, and those two women, the Sandra Oh character and the other one, never quite got that. And it's interesting, when I asked Alexander for the blurb, he said, I'll give you the blurb, but don't mention Sideways. I said, Alexander, I got to mention Sideways won the Oscar. So he allowed me to mention it, but he too, I think, has some questions about it and doesn't want that to be his whole legacy. He wrote a much better picture, in my view, prior to that, that he also directed, called About Schmidt. How many people have seen that? I think Nicholson's best work. Wonderful film. And if you remember that movie, the beginning, it's just Jack Nicholson sitting in a, there's some shots of Omaha, a bleak and dreary and bleary Omaha, Nebraska, which is where Alexander comes from. And then there's a shot of Schmidt, Jack Nicholson as Schmidt, and he's just sitting at the table of his office. He's just at the desk in his office. He's just sitting there, not doing a thing. Stock still, no motion at all. If I do that for just 6 or 7 seconds, you can feel the tension, you can feel the pressure. It gets awkward, doesn't it? And absolutely nothing is happening. I said there's absolutely no motion, but there is actually one thing that's moving. Anybody remember who saw the movie? Laura! The clock, exactly. There's a sweep second hand. I noticed that the Commonwealth Club is not yet on standard time. Go, club! They'll catch up with it in April, right?
But we do have to catch up with our radio and film audience to remind them that this is Richard Walter talking about The Hitchhiker's Guide to Radio and Television Film Writing. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne Clark. Thank you. The fact of the matter is that there is a second there is a clock with a sweep second hand, and it's ticking off the seconds, and it's about, I don't know, 25 seconds before 5 o'clock. Tick, 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 tick. And as it's ticking and nothing's happening, we do get to see the office. And we notice that the desk is absolutely clear. The walls, all the graphics are gone. The shelves are clear. And we can see in a corner of the office, there's a pile, neatly stacked up bundles that are wrapped up. And clearly, this is the stuff that used to be on the desk on the shelves, on the walls, and so on. And obviously, just looking around, we can see that Schmidt is retiring. And we can also see, I mean, this is a man who's about to retire, and we can also see that he's a stickler for detail, because finally, it tick, 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 hits 5 o'clock, he gets up and he leaves. Now, nobody would have cared if he'd left earlier. Or, you know, if he hadn't come in at all that morning, nobody would have really cared. It's his last day after many years. So maybe it tells us that he's a stickler for detail, a real by-the-books kind of detail guy. Or maybe instead of that, he's an insurance man. I think he's an actuary or something like that. And maybe he doesn't really enjoy his work, and he's been waiting to retire. He can't wait to retire. But now, actually, that it's upon him, he's afraid. What will he do with his life? What's he going to do when he has all of that freedom, you know, the freedom of one's chains and all of that they talk about? So maybe that's what's driving him. And if that's a little bit of a dilemma, not clear, that's testimony not to the weakness of the writers, but to the strength. When I say writers, I mean Alexander Payne and his writing partner, Jim Taylor. So we learn a lot about Schmidt with absolutely nothing happening. And again, if you can do that, you are home free. I'll give you one more example. I think it demonstrates it so well, and it's from the movie called Moonstruck, won the Oscar 20 years ago, John Patrick Shanley screenplay. It was directed by, who cares who directed it, it's not important. I'm pretty weary of reading catalogs, even at UCLA, that name of the film, the director of the film, the stars in the film, the craft service guy who sweeps up the cigarette butts when they used to be cigarette butts, and they leave out the guy who wrote the movie. New York Times just had a thing about Sonia Sotomayor, the new Supreme Court justice, and she was inspired by the movie called 12 Angry Men, and she had a screening of it, and it's Sidney Lumet's 12 Angry Men, the Times calls it, and they refer to it in the article several times, and Mr. Lumet was supposed to come. He's 86 years old. He couldn't attend it. Nowhere. This is the New York Times. Nowhere do they mention the name Reginald Rose, who merely wrote the sucker. You know what I'm saying? So writers do tend to get underappreciated, and maybe that's because that's our job, is to appear invisible. I think all art really ought to look sort of invisible. The Writers Guild, there's so many paranoid colleagues that I have down there. They had a campaign a few years ago, billboards in L.A. with lines of dialogue from famous movies, and they would say, a writer wrote that. It really took out a campaign, spent my dues on that. The truth is, if I'm a writer and I've written a movie and I'm in the theater where that movie is playing, and somebody gets up after the movie is over and as everybody's leaving, somebody says, wow, that Tom Cruise, he always knows just what to say. That's testimony to the good job that I did in that it appeared spontaneously to emerge from the character rather than you know, having been written by a writer. I have a pal, my old college roommate, Andy Bergman, who wrote and directed Honeymoon in Vegas and The Freshman and bunches of other stuff. He's the original creator of Blazing Saddles. He has story by credit and then shares screenplay credit with Mel Brooks and Richard Pryor and a couple of other writers. Andy, if you're at the movie theater with Andy and there's a self-conscious bunch of dialogue, he'll start typing in the air, you know, like you could hear. He'll just start typing as if you could hear the writer just off the, you know, beyond the frame creating that thing. Now, in Moonstruck, they violate one of Richie's rules, one of my most important rules, which is no scenes in restaurants. You see so many scenes in restaurants, cafes, bars, where people are just narrating the action rather than really acting it. You know, they're called actors. They're not called talkers. When a director's ready to shoot, she says, lights, camera, talk? I don't think so. Action they're calling for. And yet so much so many scenes are set. If you turn on the tube tonight when you get home and look at a TV show, look at a movie on television, you're going to see scenes in restaurants, people sitting around. But remember, I told you, everything is trumped by integration. If it moves the story forward, then it's okay. One thing I hate in scenes in restaurants is when people order the food. May I tell you about today's specials and so on? A friend of mine, Artie Mitrano, a comedian and actor, was actually a waiter in Mel Brooks's History of the World, Part 1. He's a waiter at the Last Supper. May I tell you about today? It's Jesus and the 12 of them. May I tell you about today's specials? And yet in Moonstruck, they are Danny Aiello, the man, and Cher as Loretta come into the restaurant. And they sit at the table, and the waiter says, "Let me tell you about today's specials. We got a fresh bluefish, just plucked from Sheepshead Bay, fresh and sweet like candy. I highly recommend it." And Danny Aiello says, "Okay, I'll take that." And Cher says, "Fish? You're gonna eat fish?" And he says, "Why not? Why not fish?" He says, "Why? Because you're going on, if you remember the movie, he's about to leave that night. He's going to take the red eye after this dinner. He's going to take the all-night flight to Sicily where his mother is purportedly dying." And she says, "You're going to be on that plane all night with fish in your belly. It's going to rot, and your skin is going to glow green. You'll be able to read the New York Times from you know, holding it close to your skin from the light emanating from your rotting skin from that fish." I'm just paraphrasing. It wasn't quite as good as this. He says, "I don't want fish." He says, "No, you don't want fish. So what do I want?" "Well, you want a light pasta primavera with whatever. It'll sit nice in your tummy. You'll get on that plane. You'll fall asleep. You'll nod off. You wake up. It'll be bright sunshine morning in Palermo, and you go about the sorry business that you have to go about." She says to the waiter, "What she just said, that's what I'll have, whatever she just said." And then he turns to Cher. The waiter goes to fetch their orders, and he says to Loretta, "You're an old-fashioned kind of woman. They don't make women like you anymore. You know how to take care of a man. I need a woman like you. Marry me." She says, "You call out a proposal of marriage?" He says, "What do you want me to do? Get on my knees?" He says, "Well, for openers, yeah, what about your knees? That would be good." So he gets on his knees and he proposes. So something is happening in the scene. But more than that, we're learning something really important about Cher's character, about Loretta. You remember when she goes to tell her mother that she's getting married? Her mother, played by Olympia Dukakis, won the Oscar that year for her performance, Best Supporting Role by a female actor. And she was brilliant in it, just brilliant in it. Cher says, "Mama, I'm getting married." And Olympia Dukakis says, "You love this man?" And Cher says, "No." And she says, "Good." And if you remember how they play it, "Mama, I'm getting married. You love this man? No, good." It's very fast. It's very quick. It's just throwaway. Because these are two women, and Cher in particular, Lorraine in particular, is a woman who knows what a hoax love is. That love is a joke. Any woman who falls for love, much less falls in love, is a fool. Look at the example of the parents, again, Olympia Dukakis and Vincent Gardini, who played the father. What a brilliant actor he was, rest his soul. He's cheating on her. They have a terrible, terrible relationship. That's the model for Loretta. Love is 11 minutes of fun and a lifetime of frustration and disappointment, betrayal and heartache. I know there are women in the room thinking, 11 minutes, if I could get 11 minutes from a guy. Always the optimist, Richie. So that's a very different Cher, a very different Loretta from Loretta at the end of the movie.
I'm going to have to stop, Richard, just for a minute for our 11 minutes.
Please.
For the audience. It's now time for the audience questions, and you're welcome to come to the microphone. Remember, talk directly. Is this one on? Talk directly into the mic and then ask a question. And we'll have as many questions as we can in the time that's left. So,
okay, I want to tie up the thought by simply saying that at the end of the movie, Loretta's very different from that. She's a woman who believes love is the only reason that we're here, that it's worth burning an eternity in hell if you can have love now in your lifetime. And she's not talking about some surrealistic French film with long lenses and slow motion, the lovers prancing through the daisies, Vivaldi playing in the background. She's talking about sweaty, physical, erotic, sexual love. And that's a very different Loretta from the beginning of the pictures. You can see how the ordering of the food moved that story forward, and therefore, instead of being a waste of time and a bore, it becomes a really integral and exciting part of that movie. Thank you, Anne.
And now we'll have questions that will be sexy and moving and get us into the rest of the story.
Fair enough. If nobody asks questions, I'm just going to keep talking.
I think we have a question coming.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
No
any
questions?
Challenges or confrontations?
Oh, I'm sorry.
You have to
shoot, but you gotta say it into the mic.
Oh, into the mic. Right.
Otherwise, Ann will beat you with that gavel.
Why? I know so many Hollywood films are taken from European films these days.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
So many American films, Hollywood films, are taken from European films these days. They rewrite them. For example, the up-and-coming series of The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest.
Right.
And why do you think that is?
The cowardice of production companies to do what America has always done best, what Hollywood had done best for its, most of its tenure, which is to make original movies. The sickest, the saddest thing about the American film industry is the refusal to do original work. Everything is a prequel, a sequel, a remake, an adaptation from some other medium. Not just a book, but a video game, a board game. A friend of mine who's a very successful writer has had some pictures made, has very powerful representation, CAA, Creative Artists Agency, went in to meet with his agency, had some pitches for them, and he pitched some really fine pitches. And they said, oh, those are great, 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 but they're not doing anything original. We have Mattel wants to develop projects for their toys. So you got anything for any of their toys? So he thought, maybe he would come up with something for Barbie. They said, Taken. Barbie's Taken. Well, maybe G.I. Joe. No, gone. It's funny. They have a product group at Mattel. I actually wrote the Mattel Toy Show in 1979. They have a product group called Boys, Toys, and Male Action Figures. Doesn't that sound like a double bill in the Castro? Boys, toy, and male action figures. The fact is that they said there's a new toy they have. It's called Wet Me Wendy. Wet Me Wendy. It's a little doll that pees on itself. And nobody's taken that. So he went home, and he was working on it, kind of coming up with a pitch for that. And then he told me that he decided exactly what he was having trouble with, and he decided exactly what to do. And that was to get a length of clothesline and hang himself in the backyard from an avocado tree. How did it come to this that he's trying to invent a story for a doll that pisses on itself? Please, on that note, ask me a question.
Okay, the question is, we have a screenplay, we're done, we're ready to move it. Now, it's 80 pages, 90 pages, so does it have to be a screenplay, does it have to be a movie, or can we give it to somebody else that it can become maybe a sitcom, and what do you suggest?
Well, sitcoms, television generally is developed within television. You can't. The way to get into television is through movies and through the feature-length form, a long form that might spin off to a pilot eventually and become a basis for a series. But very, very difficult to develop series from the outside. If you see who develops a series, they're people who are already established their reputations within TV. If you have a screenplay, you want to try to sell it as a screenplay. I've had modest success using screenplays as models for novels that I wrote. This is becoming more and more common. That then got published as novels and then suddenly sold as screenplays because suddenly it had the authorization of another conglomerate. They published it as a novel. There must be something to it. It must have value. Worrying about how to get a movie sold is much less important than worrying about having a movie that's worthy of being sold. Instead of worrying about how you get to an agent, worry about having a script good enough to get to an agent. And again, it's all about story. Something should happen in the first couple of lines that make you want to read to the bottom of the page. And at the bottom of the page, you're curious and you actually want to turn the page to see what's on the next page. And you want to keep that up, of course, through the length and breadth of the script. Not easy to do, very difficult to do, much easier to swim to Alameda County than to do that. A question?
There's sort of two points. I would think it's...
Got to talk right into the microphone.
It would be very hard to get a screenplay accepted in this country. There's so much...
Is it very hard to get a screenplay accepted?
They value so much that the movie has to make a lot of money. And I used to prefer a lot of foreign films. For one reason,
well, foreign films have to make money, too.
I do at times because...
I'm just going to jump in and try to address that.
They show relationships and intimate exchanges between human beings.
Well, if they're good movies, they show that, where whoever makes them. But when I came to UCLA, it was the 70s. It was the wreckage of the 60s. It was already the 70s. And the third worst thing to do is actually sell a screenplay. That was like selling out. Take money for it. The second worst thing you could do, even worse than that, was that that screenplay gets made into a movie. That's just copping to the system. It's fascism. And the worst thing, can you guess what that is? That is having a movie made that actually becomes a big hit, because audiences are, that was a huge commercial success. Audience was are morons and fools and so on. We don't believe in that, and I want to disabuse you of that notion. All of the great dramas going all the way back to the ancient Greek era were hugely successful. Agamemnon, Medea, Lysistrata, Oedipus Rex, these were not obscure little lost little plays. They were great big commercial successes in their own era. Shakespeare, ditto. Hamlet and Macbeth, and these were very successful in their era. And it is not a sin or a scandal in mass communication to reach the masses, not a sin or a scandal in public and popular communication to reach the public and the populace. And look at what Oedipus Rex and Medea are about. It's about, you know what Oedipus Rex is about? It's a guy who kills his father, who marries his mother. What's significant about that? You know what's significant about it. This is a guy who makes a journey in two different directions in his lifetime in the same birth canal. Think about it. And if that makes you awkward and feels uncomfortable, that's what Sophocles wanted. So I knew Sophocles. He was a friend of mine. I see the picture of Dan Quayle out there. Isn't he the guy who said that? Maybe not Quayle. The fact of the matter is that Medea murders her own children in a jealous rage over the faithlessness of her husband, their father. Macbeth kills his own king, and not for any noble purpose. Hamlet ends up with 9 corpses on the stage. Some have been run through on swords. Some have been poisoned. Nobody wants to see the Village of the Happy Nice People. This was not invented by 11 Jews in a dark room at Paramount Studios, 3 weeks ago last Thursday. Don't be afraid of commercial success. If you don't care about audience reaction, you can work in other media. Poetry, painting, these are noble forms. You know, if you're a painter, you just need one patron. But if you're working in film, Orson Welles said a painter needs a brush, a poet needs a pen, a filmmaker needs an army. It does need to be able to pay for itself. It doesn't need to be a blockbuster triumph, but no sin if it is. But it at least has to reach more than the immediate friends and family of the person who made the film. I'm not a big fan of the Star Wars franchise, but what he's saying there is a fabulously important lesson about the power of good over the power of evil, the power of construction and the power of love over the power of destruction, the power of hate, and so on. Just because it's hugely commercially successful doesn't mean it is not a worthy and timeless work. Please, sir.
So my question is, if how do you go about making sure you're not overanalyzing, paralysis by analysis. You said something earlier about 21 days was too long. What's a good time?
Well, I think it takes actually longer than that. I was just kind of goofing on Vicky, whom I love, I adore. But what a good question that is. Because that's one of the problems we have at UCLA. We have such good writers, but they tend to overthink everything because they're so savvy, they're so hip to the business and so on. You have to stay open to the surprise. You have to have an outline, I believe, but then you got to throw that outline away. I never knew a writer who wasn't surprised by twists and turns in a story, by lines of dialogue that a character seemed to invent all by herself. We rejoice in Los Angeles in having near our campus and in our community some pretty famous writers who come down and visit the school and talk to us. I had Neil Simon come in to talk about comedy. That's like being in seminary and having, like, at 4 o'clock, the Lord will be, talking to students, doing a Q&A. And I asked Mr. Simon, I said, do you laugh at your own jokes? And he says, sure I do, the first time I hear them. And it's interesting. It's as if they are spoken to him by the characters. Never knew a writer didn't have that experience. I see heads nodding around the room. I've never spoken to a group of writers and recalled that. recounted that without seeing. Everybody agree? We all know that if we stand alone in the room and tried it, we know that that is the way it works. So the trick is not to have expectations, to stay open, as I say, to the surprises. I think this is a useful in your life narrative as well as in your dramatic narrative. I can't tell you, for example, how thrilling it is for me, how touched I am to be here right now with people like you who care enough to come out tonight and go to the trouble to spend this time with me. I never had this plan. Can you imagine if I was planning this? Jewish kid like me, the thing to do growing up in New York City was be a doctor, and I know a zillion doctors, and some of them are very, very happy. Many of them are not. This one wishes he was an anthropologist, and this one wishes he was an oceanographer, and many of them wish they were screenwriters, and we have them in the screenwriting program at UCLA. There are physicians, there are lawyers who've achieved their dream, and it turns out to be a nightmare, and they want to be creative. They want to be creative. And you have to sort of instead of focusing very clearly on a goal, I think your best bet, it sounds funny to say this, but I mean it from the bottom of my heart, your best bet is to stumble around dumbly and stupidly and blindly, and when you bang into things that you love, grab onto them and hang on to them. I fell into this at UCLA at a party in Malibu that I went to reluctantly because I felt I owed an obligation to the person who was throwing the party. He'd been very supportive of my career and so on. And then I got invited to the UCLA program. I wasn't looking for a job. I was a busy writer. And thank God I was driven to by my guilt. That's another thing they'll tell you. Forget about guilt. Guilt is your friend. Keeps your butt in the chair. Keeps your hands on the keys. Don't you think this would be a better world if more people were in touch with their guilt?
Unfortunately, we've come to just the point in the program where we have two more questions, and
okay,
we will hear from you, and then as the chair gets, guess who's going to win this guest, gets to ask the last question.
Okay.
Who has the gavel, by the way?
Oh, I can't wait for that gavel. I don't know if I'll make it to the gavel.
I was wondering what you think of collaborative work as opposed to individual work, and what a screenwriter might look for in a collaborator.
What a good question. Collaboration. A lot of writers collaborate. It makes good sense. It's much less lonely. I mean, writing is a lonely enterprise, and if you collaborate, you have somebody to share the pain. All of film is collaboration. Co-labor. Co means with. Labor, work, work with. That's the beauty of working in film. A lot of writers say to me that the downside to writing for the screen is so many people come between you and the final product, the movie. That's not the downside. That's the upside. That's the fun of it. That's what makes it special. It's the joy of being part of a creative family of artists and craftspeople who are diverse and yet create this single unified enterprise that is the film. If you can find a partner to write with, and again, it's just like finding partners in life, you can't figure it out in advance. You have to try it out and see if it works or see if it doesn't work. And if you run through several and it doesn't work, so what? You know, most people don't marry the first person that they meet. But I think it's absolutely appropriate. My own experience as a writer has been writing by myself, but also occasionally collaborating, mainly by myself, mainly solo. But I have also collaborated. And I remember I was collaborating with a woman on a project, and somebody said to her, so are you sleeping with him? And she said, oh, we're doing something so much more perverse than that. We're writing a screenplay together. Did we want to have a last, another?
Right, I get the last question.
Okay,
how's that? I'll be perverse. What do you think? What's your view of the future when we have YouTube and blogs and handheld devices, iPods? What do you see? What do you see?
I see joy. I see a bounty of possibilities that we don't even know what's going to be. But mainly what I see, we were discussing this with Mr. Turgeon Richard just before when we got started, two things have happened as a result of all of this. One thing, prices have crashed in terms of production. You can make a movie for like $11.09 now, practically. It's astonishing how inexpensive. What's his name? Ed Norton? Is that the actor who made a movie with like $25,000? I mean, you couldn't even buy breakfast. You can buy coffee for the drivers on Avatar for $25,000. And they made a whole movie. Now, so that's the first thing. You don't need to be a studio. You don't even need to have investors. You can really finance it yourself. Do it on the fly. handheld. If you have a good script, that's the most important aspect of it, of course. The other thing about it is distribution. It used to be a, distribution is the name of the game. It has been in commerce forever. And now that's changing because everybody has worldwide distribution at their desk. There's the web. The question is, how do you get attention? But want to bear in mind, you don't need any longer, since it costs so little, you don't need any longer to reach gazillions of people, hundreds of millions of people, do $100 million the first weekend and so on. It's so much easier to make back your nut. So you have two things that I think are hugely desirable. One, much more opportunity for artists who want to work in this format to do it without being, corporate entities and having that kind of financial support. And the other thing you have is for audiences a much wider variety of alternative stuff to see. You know, what's not to like about that? Your webisodes, your mobisodes, all of that, it's all happening. The film schools are looking into all of that. They still are stories. They're just shorter. They still have beginnings, middles, and ends. They still have to do all of the things that you need to do in a longer form, and that is to say, engage the audience. You can only get away with tone, poems, and texture and, like, flashing images for, 30, 40 seconds. After a while, in a hurry, people want a story.
Our thanks to Richard Walters and we also thank our audiences here and on radio and film, television, and the internet. I'm Ann Clark, and now I'm a little bit scared about this gavel business, but this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating more than 107 years of enlightened discussion in the know is adjourned.